Hi, podcasters. This is Brooke with Let's Talk Art. Today I'm talking art with artist Michael Berger. Mike is an art teacher by day and an artist, podcast host, YouTuber by night. It's been a while since we last chatted, and I wanted to see what he's been up to. Making fabulous art of his own and some great videos to be sure. We also share a love of art history, so I wanted to see who he's profiled recently. We talk about Van Gogh, Toulouse-Lautrec, and the Dada movement, just to name a few. Enjoy! I've never been smart with investments or stocks, but one thing I've learned over the years is that an investment in knowledge pays the best interest. If you want to get smart with your money, you can trade smarter and maximize your returns with Trade with UFOs. Trade with UFOs is a brand that represents a community of users trading with predictive tools. You don't have to be good with stocks. They literally hold your hand while you trade, teaching you everything you need to know. You see, Trade with UFOs is also a portal which provides access to predictive apps, courses, and coaching, all to show you how to make money using unfilled orders. Why am I so passionate about this? Because then we'll all have more money in our pockets to buy more art. It's time to get smart with your money. Leverage your success with Trade with UFOs. Go to tradewithufos.com and use my offer code Brooke for a 50% off discount on all of their products. That's B-R-O-O-K-E.
Hello.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Good.
Good to see ya.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Doing great. Great. What have you been up to?
Oh, you know, just the holiday stuff, you know.
Yeah, I got your tree in the background.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, oh. The whole holiday thing.
So, did you guys have a good one?
Yeah, for the most part, you know. Some... sickness and things like that, but for the most part, you know, it goes.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah,
it comes and goes. It happens.
Have you stayed safe from COVID?
Oh yeah, I have. Awesome. Our house has been pretty fortunate. So
awesome, very cool. Yeah, same with us. Same with us. Yeah. So I am like so digging your YouTube channel.
Oh yeah, there's a ton of stuff on there.
A lot of great stuff on there.
Yeah.
A lot of great stuff. And I was curious, I mean, you're in North Carolina, right?
No, I'm in Iowa now. I was in North Carolina for about 5 years, and now okay. I've moved to Iowa.
So okay. When we had talked last, you were in North Carolina and going back to Iowa or in Iowa.
Yeah. So yeah, those are the two spots, I guess.
Cool. But I'm an NC as well.
Yeah. And, you know, North Carolina's, you know, it's great. You got the mountains and the ocean and the whole thing. And I was just flat and boring, but I guess anywhere you go is exciting. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So very cool. I was watching your video on Diane Arbus.
Okay.
I had never heard of her. And oh my gosh, she's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, and I try to find all kinds of interesting characters from art history, or whether it's the way they create or the way that they think or the way, you know, that the whole process works for them, whether that's in the studio or just their thought processes.
Right.
And, exactly. Try to put that together. It's really interesting.
Yeah, that is so cool. So like how do you like walk me through the process of you finding an artist and just kind of like.
So usually it's from something that I've read, like right now, for example, I'm reading a really interesting book on Frida Kahlo.
Yeah.
And this particular book focuses on her times that she came into the United States. A lot of people think that she was Mexican and she was always in Mexico because you stay where you're from, which is obviously untrue. People can move or visit places,
right?
And it talks about her experiences coming to the United States with Diego Rivera,
yeah,
and experiencing coming to the United States through her lens is really, really fascinating to me. Yeah. And so sometimes it's something that I'll read or something that I'll pick up like that.
Right.
And then I'll kind of dive into the little nuggets and the minutiae of the stories, try to find other supporting information, other, artifacts and writings and diaries and things like that that I can support that information with. And then I'll kind of shuffle it together and lay it out.
Neat.
And that's kind of the process. But usually it's someone that like I'll have read about, or sometimes it's just topical. I did one on Grandma Moses recently, and the one on her was just like, well, it's Christmas time. I want to do some Christmas themed stuff. So, why not focus on, like a what's Christmassy? Well, there are a couple of stories that I had of hers that were kind of topical to Christmas, so to speak. And so, this is the right time to pull that one out. So I've got several stories lined up. Right now, I'm working on one for Vermeer. I'm working on a focus on a particular artwork by Brunelleschi and by Peter Bruegel the Elder. I'm working on a story of Richard Serra and Deborah Butterfield. So I'm kind of looking at lots of different things, and I have 1,000 notebooks and just tuck the story here and tuck the story there as I find them. And it's just how it works.
Now, did you study you studied art history in college, right?
I did a lot of art history in college. My focus is actually my degree was actually in education. I started as an art major and then transitioned from art into art history, or pardon me, from art into art education, focusing on a lot of art history as well as drawing was my study of expertise, I suppose. And then I got my master's in education and did a lot of art history classes for that, and went on and taught at the collegiate level, Art 101, which is where I get the name from,
Start
obviously.
one-on-one, yeah,
And
love that.
so I do all kinds of things. And since then, we've done, as social media has evolved, I do shorter videos and clips and things like that, and longer content and videos, as well as the started a podcast recently. So
I
kind
saw
of dipping my finger and toes into all kinds of things. So
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I was curious how like video works because I'm so I'm like it took me so long to like just figure out how to do the podcast, but with that those kind of mechanics and those kind of
yeah.
technologies, and I don't even want to delve into video because I know I'll mess that up. And there's something kind of comforting about not. Even though we're doing all this on Zoom and we can see each other,
Right.
I'm just recording the audio, so it'll just be the audio that's playing. So there's
Right.
something kind of comforting about not being seen, but I would eventually like to delve into video, but I just don't know.
And it is another layer of, I do my podcast that I do on YouTube and as well as on other platforms that are just audio, but I also have the video element to it, and that's always the downside. It's like, okay, like this camera's like this, and you have to think of not just think about how the audio's turning out, but how all of these things are coming together. And it's just one more thing, like, okay, we want to record this, but the lighting is bad, or whatever the case might be. And so it's just again, there are those elements of consideration, like, oh my gosh, we want to do this, but XYZ is in our way. So I guess it's in terms of occupational hazards, it's really not that big of a deal, but for most people, but I guess that's the name of the game that we're playing.
Yeah, for sure. But that's awesome. But your videos are so great. And your
Yeah,
information.
I try to put time into each one, making unique little clippets, putting little transitional things in there, and again, as things have changed and evolved, now you can, like with my longer videos, I can make chapters and people can kind of jump around like they could on a DVD when people watched DVDs.
I remember that.
So
I remember when DVD first.
it's a nice thing to be able to incorporate those things, but I find myself starting from the beginning and trying to get everything else in sync. But with some of that stuff, it's a never-ending process if you do that. You just gotta have to, okay, we're starting from this point, moving forward, we'll do this thing and let it be satisfied with the old product without having to rework it.
Well, the one thing I love about your art history podcast is that just you make it so like the average person is not interested in art history, but you make it so interesting. I mean, you make it like so like I am interested in art history, but I mean, if I wasn't, I think I'd still be intrigued by it.
I think that there are, that's the one thing. I mean, there are artists, and as an artist, I get that, we don't want to spend all of our time looking at art history, but I think that there are those, even as artists, it's important for us to look at where we've come or what people have done things so that we understand the logic behind it. I think that there are a lot of times people just have this assumption that, well, it's okay to do this because, this other artist did it. Where, okay, well, why did that other artist do it? Well, who knows? Well, I'm going to tell you why. Or I'm going to find out why, or I'm going to try to give you some insight to that. And there are lots of really great stories that people are like, oh, art history, it's so dry and boring. Well, let me tell you about Piero Manzoni and how unboring he was, and the way he thought about things and the way he created things. And that's just one person. I mean, that's not even the millions and billions of artists and people that have made art and created art. There's a lot of stuff that doesn't have to be dry and boring. And sometimes when you have to study it, I had a former student of mine go back into some of my stuff and send me a note somewhat recently and say, when I was in art history class, having to study for that test, I mean, it was like, oh my gosh. But now I don't have to worry about a test. I don't have to worry about all of those things. And there's no pressure to have to memorize anything or learn anything. I'm just able to enjoy the story for the at face value. And so I appreciate that too.
Without having to remember dates and stuff like that.
Who wants that?
Really. But even though it is kind of interesting to know about, the time frame that they were in, but I mean, not that you have to know that.
And sometimes putting little tidbits for context is also important. And I'll do that in there as well, just so people get a sense of the time and the all arts as a whole. In some cases, when you're looking at certain artists, understanding the music that was popular, it's really hard to talk about someone like Kandinsky without also talking about the influence of jazz music
The music
that was
album.
put on why he was making art that looked like that. Or talking about Jacob Lawrence. Well, you can't talk about Jacob Lawrence without talking about the Harlem Renaissance, and you can't really talk about the Harlem Renaissance without talking about the literature and the complete style of the Harlem Renaissance, not just the visual side. So anyway, it becomes a snowball. So sometimes you have to say, okay, I have enough stuff.
I have to stop.
You can go on forever.
Totally. I was reading something the other day about
You know how they say Van Gogh chopped off his own ear and sent it to a prostitute? Well, I
found out that there's a theory that Gauguin chopped it off in a
With the sword, yeah. That's an interesting one because There are three versions of the story, and that's the least credible of the three. But there are people that they're like, yeah, Gauguin may have gotten mad at him and hit him in the head with a sword and removed his ear, and Van Gogh, not wanting him to get into trouble, kind of covered for him. There's a
Why would
story.
he? Why would he not want him? If he cut off my ear, I'd be really mad. I'd want him to get in trouble.
Well, I think that because he was trying to start this art colony called the Studio of the South, and so his brother Theo, or Theo as us Americans would enunciate it, said, "Hey, I'll get this relatively popular contemporary artist to come and stay with you and get this Studio of the South thing rolling." And so it was October, Gauguin moves in, and they're instantly oil and water. Like, their art is different, their approach is different, everything about what they're doing is just so polar opposite. It's no secret that Gauguin was something of he enjoyed the nightlife, so to speak, and all of the vices that go along with that. And so his partaking in various things, and Van Gogh was not very social in those sorts of ways. And so there was, again, conflict. And another theory of the story is that that Van Gogh had in a fit of just being out of his mind, takes his ear and removes it. The version of the story that I feel is probably the most accurate is that he had a seizure and actually removed his own ear in a fit of a seizure. The people didn't know that he had very severe lead poisoning. And the lead poisoning, because he was ingesting paint, and he was ingesting paint because he was out on the field and he couldn't take all the turpentines and thinners necessary to clean his brushes. If his brushes got ruined, then he was done for as a painter. That's kind of a necessary tool.
For
And so he was sucking the paint out of the brushes to clean
sure.
them
Oh my gosh.
and then giving himself lead poisoning in the process. And long story short, he developed a tendency to have seizures, and in one of those seizures, he, according to the stories and accounts that I've read, removed the better part of his ear. And then, for again unknown reasons, that I've read the original court records, because there was a police report and all of these different things. It was published in several newspapers. But for some unknown reason, because this was December the 23rd, and then so the Christmas Eve, he goes to a prostitute's a brothel and delivers his ear to a woman that worked there. She wasn't a prostitute; she just happened to work there, and he was smitten with her. And she had been a he had met her previously in Paris when he lived there. His brother, he met through his brother, and she had been attacked by a dog. She had scars all over her face. And so he's like, "Well, you have scars, now I'm disfigured, so I'll give you my ear and now we can be friends." And he, again, being a little socially unique, he thought that that would work, and it didn't.
Because they did it.
No, they never, there's no account of them ever communicating again. But I suppose if somebody gave me their severed anything, I probably wouldn't want to talk to them a whole lot after that. But
No.
that's me.
Yeah, me too.
I don't know. Again, it's hard to put ourselves in the logic of something that happened years and years and years ago. But yeah, it's always interesting to, again, to try to figure the story out and to find these other things and discover, okay, because there were conflicts to the story. Like in one story that was written in the newspaper at the time, it said that he delivered his ear to a prostitute. And digging, you find, okay, she wasn't. That's not accurate. And here's that, you know, here was her role. And here, why was her role that? Well, dig more. Oh, here's why. And you learn all of these interesting little side notes that kind of come together to form a better story or a more complete story. And
I think that's interesting. And I think the article that I was reading was talking about whether it was a part like a was it if it was just like the top of his ear that he cut or like the whole ear.
yeah, and again, that's another part of the historic uniqueness to these old stories. Because for years, when I first learned of Vincent Van Gogh and his ear, I had learned that it was his entire ear. And then I went back in college and they said, no, it was just his lower lobe. And then I'm digging and digging into these stories, and I find the original an interview that was done with the doctor that treated him at the time, and he even drew a diagram showing here's where, and all that was left was the lower lobe. So it wasn't the entire ear, but the top lobe, and leaving the bottom lobe attached. And it's again, it's digging into these stories and also being willing to say, you know, the story that I originally heard, that wasn't right. And to nobody's fault, I mean, it was just we read a book or watch a movie. I don't know how many people have watched the 1957 movie Lust for Life or read the book of the same title by Irving Stone, Irving Stone, I believe. But at any rate, reading those things and taking that novel as truth, and you know, the agony and the ecstasy is a really great story, but there are parts of it that just flatly are historically untrue. You know, we can't read the Da Vinci Code and say, this is, you know, this is a fact. It's just one person's impression, and making a novel out of something that contains a lot of true things, but also it's a novel. There's a reason that it's called a novel. So in all of those, instances, you know.
And I think like what you were saying about, I think like when you hear one way and you start to think of it as one way, it was one situation, and you just it's hard to kind of separate yourself from if you hear something else, you're like, oh no, that can't be right. That can't be right. It's this way. It's this way. This is how I heard it. It is very hard. And I think that I don't know. I think a lot of people are experiencing that.
And that's really hard. It's hard to build a reality. You know, our perception becomes our reality, whether our perception is accurate or not. It becomes what we believe is true. And we have to be willing to say, okay, let's lay the evidence out. And I'm not going to tell the story that I heard 30 years ago. And there are a lot of people that say, well, here's an old book from the 50s. I mean, how much has art history changed? Well, it's actually changed a lot. And how we find research, and how we do research, how we find archives or artifacts, and things come to light, and we have to be willing to say, you know, the original story that was told had some things in it that, for whatever reason, they didn't want us to know. They didn't want, they didn't have it right. And not that we have to have everything right, because sometimes, you know, does it make a really good story that Vincent Van Gogh and Paul Gauguin got into a sword fight, and one cut the other's ear off? Yeah, that's a really, that could be a really interesting scene in a movie. But does that make And I get hung up on that sort of thing. Like the watching movies with me is always like if they're based on something historical and if I have a good idea of the truth, like I'll be like, that's not right. I recently watched there was a movie about Kurt Warner that came out not too long ago, and I remember watching the Kurt Warner movie. And they were like, and it's the Unidome where, and I went to the University of Northern Iowa, and they're talking about the Unidome, and they're playing in a just a stadium, and I'm like, this doesn't even have a dome on it. How can they? And this isn't Cedar Falls. This isn't where he played. This isn't like it's. This isn't even the right state. This isn't the right atmosphere for any of this. But again, sometimes you have to be like, okay. They're filming this during a pandemic. All right, we can't fault them for not being able to film at a university. But at the same time, it's like, just tell me the real story. Show me the real picture. And I get hung up on the wrong things probably, but that's the way it goes.
So does your family not like watching historical movies with you?
Well, yeah, if I know, again, if I know, like, for example, if I went to the Napoleon movie, I would just enjoy it because I really don't know that much about Napoleon. But if you, but if it was like based on art history, I can probably like, there are some things within like the Jackson Pollock movie, Pollock or Frida Kahlo's movie, Frida, both of them are pretty darn close to accurate with a lot of the things that are told in their story. So, but then, I'll watch another movie about, another artist or like the Vincent van Gogh movies, the old ones. And it's like, holy smokes, this is, or even the newer one, which was really, really well done, cinematically, the way they made the movie through to look like a moving painting was just phenomenal. But then there are some so-called theories that are interjected into it that aren't completely known. And when you tell something, when people watch that, they're like, oh, this is the way it was. I know, I saw the movie. Well, that's not, and you got people like Michael Orr in the from the Blind Side, who's now he's coming out saying, listen, that movie isn't, that's, it's not all true. It's a movie, it's Hollywood, it's, and even filmmakers will say, yeah, there's things that we do to change the story because we want to tell
Because, yeah.
a different, we want to tell a different story than what really happened, which
Oh, okay.
and so it's interesting,
Yeah, for
and
sure.
we can't rely on on a Hollywood production as a document of historical fact.
No, for sure. So
Anyway.
if you were to make a movie of any artist, what artist would that be?
Boy, if I was to make a movie without being vain, I'd say myself, but no, if I if I had to make a movie about any artist. Boy, I think that there are so many artists that have really, really, really good stories about them for different reasons. I think that, if you wanted to tell a story of overcoming, and just becoming the best version of yourself or whatever, I think that there are certain artists you could pick. If you want to talk about being a creative spirit, there are other artists you could pick. I think it depends on the type of story that you would want to tell. But for me, I would love to see a story about a movie about the Impressionists, not just necessarily any one, but because there, and I recently did a series of this on my channel, but also I think it would make a really good story. I think that Edgar Degas would be a really good heel, bad guy in the movie, because he kind of hijacked the Impressionist art exhibitions
Yeah.
that took place, and had they followed their better instincts and let other people take the lead,
Yeah.
they probably would have been more frequent and more well served. But I think that it would just be interesting to follow those characters for a 14, 15-year period of time from the beginning of that first art exhibition to the eighth art exhibition,
Yeah.
and how that kind of evolved, and how people got their feelings hurt, and people got mad and left, and opinions were shared back and forth, and then the competition that they wanted to have between their little group and the Paris Salon, and all of those things, I think would make a really a captivating story that I think could hold people's
Oh
attention
yeah. Yeah, totally.
for a period of time. And I think
Love
that,
Love Delicious.
that'd be a good one.
Yeah, that'd be great. So tell me what you're doing in your art.
Right now, artistically, I'm working on a series on maps. I did a over the years since college, I would work periodically on maps. I would take old maps and do drawings and paintings and all kinds of things on them. And
Cool.
I've kind of gotten back to that. I got an old atlas, and took the page, world atlas, took the d different pages out. And so I'm doing a series of pop culture icons on top of the maps. So
Cool.
I will do characters from different movies, but I'll never re and I don't know if every artist is like this, but I make these obscure rules for myself that I feel like I have to follow.
Right.
And I don't know exactly why I do that, but I feel like that's necessary for my process
Part of the
to say,
process, I understand.
like, all right, these are my rules. And then it's like, I want to break that rule, but I know I can't. So, and I'm a rule follower in
Yeah.
that. So I stick to it, and I make, unnecessary notes
Yeah.
and lists and things, and know exactly what I got to do. But anyway, it's a series of I'm working on a series of 75 different maps. Each one is worked on for a very specific length of time. I work on them for an hour and a half. I don't work on them any longer than that. After the hour and a half is up, I'm done.
Well, that's awesome.
And so there's a
It's like
kind of a
complete.
time constraint, so that none of them is worked or whatever more than another. Each one is from a different movie. I'll take movie characters. So, for example, I did one on Pulp Fiction, taking the character of Jules, and I put him on top of a map of California because that's where the movie takes place. So I try to do that. I did one of Jeff Bridges as the dude in the
Yeah,
Big Lebowski,
love that.
and I put him over a map of Iraq because at the very beginning of the movie, he's walking through the grocery store, and it talks about, and it has a clip of President George Bush,
Let's say
the
discuss
first,
that scene.
talking about the conflict with Iraq. And it's brought up throughout the movie
Yeah.
by various characters. And so I put the dude on top of Iraq.
Love that.
And so, when you have a map, and it's like, okay, once I use California, California is used. So you have to find, so okay, any other movie that is set in California, I've got to think, okay, what else is brought up in the movie where I could put this character? And if it doesn't make sense, then I don't make it.
Yeah. I
But
love that. I love maps, and I think that's a fantastic idea. I think that's such a great creative way that you paired those things together. I think
well, and it's when you're doing something, in my mind, doing something pop culture, putting something pop culture on top of something that's the kind of the subject of pop culture, with Jasper Johns made a fortune
Map.
off of maps and targets and boring things. And so using that everyday object as a media of sorts, as a surface to create on, I think is kind of interesting.
You're making it as a ready-made.
Right, for sure, for sure.
I love that. I think that's awesome.
And so that's kind of the what I'm doing right now. I'm working those in ink and colored pencil. So and I limit my palettes, usually in each one. And there's other elements that are incorporated into it. So there's a consistent theme through all of the works, and that's the current thing.
Cool. I love it. I absolutely love it. That is so cool. So where can people find you?
Oh boy, people can find me all over the place. I'm all over social media. My biggest presences are on TikTok, YouTube, video type formats. The easiest way to find me is do a search for Mr. Burger, MR period BURGHER, and search away. You'll find me. I don't do a lot with the platform formerly known as Twitter. I don't know what it's even called anymore. I don't know if you're supposed to call it X or if that's the logo. I'm not really sure. But I don't really use that a whole lot. I have it. I don't use it a lot. So there are some social media platforms that I'm on, I just don't use. But if you do a search for Mr. Burger, you'll find me just about anywhere and everywhere. And
Awesome.
I'm always keen on input and feedback. So if there's an artist that you really want to hear about, or you want me to do a little bit of research into, I'd love to create something that would be like, hey. And I've had several people do that over the years. People said, hey, do you know anything about this art or this style? No, I don't. But let me do some research, and I'll make something. I love that.
I'm big into the Dada artists,
Oh yeah.
because and the art is not pretty to look at. I don't like the art, but you're not supposed to like the art. I just like the philosophy and the theory behind it. And honestly,
Right.
they're probably I don't think I would like the people. I mean, they seem like very, very. I think the artist's philosophy is a little bit contrary to mine. But I love just the whole thing about like making something not pretty, like
Yeah.
marketable and or something like that. I think that's making art anti-art.
Yeah. And I think that there are a lot of really strong characters in the throughout the Dada and early surrealist movements that, I mean, you could make a movie about any one of those folks, because they're doing all kinds of just interesting, innovative things. And I think that that's the name of the game, just trying to do something creative and innovative and tell your story, as bizarre or straightforward as it might be, and authentically just put yourself out there. And boy, the Dada and surrealists, early surrealists, were definitely in that vein for sure.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. This has been so
Yeah, I
awesome.
appreciate
I
you for the
really,
invitation, and I love coming back and visiting with you. And
yeah. And I'm sorry it's been so long, but
oh no.
we'll have to do it again very soon.
For sure. Yeah. Anytime. Anytime.
For sure. So you have a great rest of the day, and
You
I
as well. We'll
thank
see you
you
next time.
next time, and I'll let you know when this posts.
You bet. Thank you.
Thanks. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much to Michael Berger for taking the time to chat with me. It was so great to catch up, and I've really been enjoying your channel. If you want to see more of Mike's art or videos, go to MrBurgerArt.com or his YouTube channel, Mr. Berger. As always, if you're finding value in these episodes, please like, subscribe, share, or consider sponsoring. Thanks for listening. This is a Hotspur Media production. More music by Corey Knoxville.